Good morning. Welcome to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and this week we're going to talk about a topic that you may be unfamiliar with. It's called dry needling. My guest is Dr. David Fishkin. He's a chiropractor from Maryland. He has a master's in public health. He's been in chiropractic practice for 23 years. He's been doing dry needling since 1998, and has been teaching dry needling since 2008. Welcome, Dr. Fishkin.
Thank you, Dr. Goldin. Pleasure to be here with you.
Okay, so I'm gonna lay it on you. What is dry needling?
Dry needling is a technique to treat the soft tissues of the body, meaning the muscular tissues, the tendinous tissues, and tissues that we call fascial tissues, which are basically the tissues which hold all the other tissues together. It's sort of the glue of the body, but it's an intelligent glue that has a lot of communication throughout the body. And we use very fine, hair-thin needles that are placed into painful tissue to release the pressure in that tissue and to allow the tissue to function in a more normal way.
Okay, so let's talk about where did this idea come from?
Well, it really goes back probably to the early 30s. As many things developed in medicine and in health, they started in England, just as in public health, where the concept of clean water started in England. So did this concept of the understanding of pain and its mechanisms. And the idea of dry needling really started in the 30s with a particular doctor named Dr. Kellgren, who began to experiment with injecting various substances into the muscular tissues and documented these in a paper in 1938. Later on, a more famous doctor who was more famous in our time, Dr. Janet Trevell, which many people in the public know, really evolved the major theories underlying the treatment of soft tissue pain, or what she called trigger points. Although she didn't invent that term either, and she didn't invent that concept, she built upon it in a very big and broad way with her colleague, Dr. Simons. Later, in the 70s, in the same time period that the United States, China opened up to the United States, and we discovered the Asian technique of acupuncture that's been around for thousands of years, in that same time period, there were other people developing approaches in this country, one being Dr. Lewitt is a Czech physician, and a Canadian physician, Dr. C-Chan Gunn, were using needles, basically hollow bore needles initially, but later the same type of needles that acupuncturists use, which are solid core, very thin hair-like needles, to treat painful tissue. So in a parallel fashion, in the 70s, many things were happening. So I would say that in the 70s, that's where the concept of dry needling really took root here in the West, using Western modes of anatomy and physiology to as the basis for what we do, differing from the acupuncture, which uses Asian theories of medicine and rationales of why and where they place needles. Same tool, different approaches.
Okay, so one of the things that's that may be confusing is the term dry needling, which is differentiating doing an injection, a needle that has something in it, like lidocaine or cortisone, versus a hollow needle that has nothing in it, or just like an acupuncture-type needle.
Right. Typically, correct. Wet needling is exactly that, injecting a substance through a hollow needle, through a beveled hollow needle, whereas dry needling is using pure, sterile stainless steel, using without any drugs or any substances directly into the tissue, which is not painful.
Oh, right. Well, that's one of the things people always ask about, you know, anything to do with a needle. Will it hurt?
No. The reason injection needles are painful because of their shape, and they actually tear tissue, which leads to scar formation. And anyone who, for example, takes injections regularly, who's doing fertility or for diabetes, will develop problems with the soft tissue getting scars there, granulomas they call them.
Mm-hmm.
This does not happen with dry needling at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about who does dry needling. You said that it's different from acupuncture, so we'll leave acupuncture out of this for now.
Yes. First of all, dry needling is much more well-known in Europe, is done more broadly in Europe. But in this country, it's being done primarily by chiropractors and physical therapists.
Right. In the state of Washington, physical therapists do it.
Yes. It varies. But what people may not know is that each state, aside from medicine, all the other professions are state-run in terms of their law, and the laws vary state by state as to what, for example, the physical therapists or the chiropractors can do within those states. So in some states, a PT can do it and a chiro can't. In others, a chiro can and a PT can't. And in some cases, both can. And in some cases, neither can.
Now, as of the last time I checked, there were 15 states where chiropractors are allowed to do dry needling. Is that still the number?
Yes, it really hasn't changed from my initial entry into doing this, because I became nationally involved in this. Because I found, based on a request from a doctor, that his state should allow it, which was Oregon, but wasn't allowing it at the time. And therefore, I got involved in studying all the laws of all 50 states, initially of the chiropractic profession. I'm now studying them more and more on the physical therapy side, because I'm teaching them as well. And I found about 25 of the 50 states should allow it, if you look at their state law.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, as I began to write each of the states that should allow it, of the 25, 15 accepted it, 10 for various political, economic reasons were hedging. So we haven't resolved those totally yet, but we're going to work on it.
Well, okay, so why would a doctor want to add dry needling to their practice?
A doctor wants to add this because the citizens of their state are going to benefit tremendously. People who have either acute or chronic pain will benefit. The acute patients are going to resolve much faster. The chronic patients who are often dependent on drugs may be able to lessen their dependence, maybe not completely, but improve their condition or stabilize their condition.
Well, let's talk about some different problems. Like, let's say, a person sprained their back. They overlifted, and they come in.
Yes.
And they have an acute,
They can barely move. This type of case happens on a fairly routine basis in my office. And
every day?
Just about. Sometimes the patient has to be helped in by a friend,
mm-hmm.
and then they hobble into your treatment room.
Mm-hmm.
You examine them, and in the past, we would do other various manual therapies, which were helpful,
mm-hmm.
but took some more time. This approach cuts the time by a fraction. So that a patient who walks in an acute state, has to be helped in, can barely walk, can walk out literally on their own. It's if you didn't experience it and weren't the beneficiary of this approach, you wouldn't believe it. You would think I was making it up. In fact, sometimes I pinch myself when it happens, because it happens fairly frequently, and I really chuckle every time it happens, because it's amazing and it's wonderful.
So it's another therapeutic tool that a doctor can use to
Combine it with other tools, even that much better.
You mean like manipulation, maybe ultrasound or
manipulation,
laser?
Ultrasound, electrical stim,
mm-hmm.
And it allows you to move, for example, from the acute state then into the rehabilitative state much more rapidly, so
uh-huh.
that patient is losing less time from work, their stress from the pain is down much more quickly, they're much happier.
Okay, so then let's talk about a different scenario. So we have someone who has long-term low back pain, and they're probably on some kind of a hydrocodone, or actually I have a patient who's been on morphine for 5 years.
Right, and what about an installed pain pump in their bodies?
Right,
I mean,
okay.
Some of these patients are completely dependent on these drugs just to function. Now, these patients are not addicts. They're just dependent. There's a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
These patients, while on serious medications, can function, but they need those medications in order to function, whereas an addict just needs that to supply their addiction. So it's a different scenario, but a chronic pain patient needs those drugs to function. But what happens with this technique is you start to nip away at their need for maybe the dosage or the intensity or the frequency of that medicine. So they begin to come off of that to some extent. Not in all cases, but they achieve a much more stable state and a much more comfortable state. Those, of course, are very severe cases. You have lesser severe cases, which are not drug-dependent per se, but they're constantly miserable. Those patients improve quite a bit. So their misery is less, and their function improves. So life is better. We can't cure many of these patients, but better control, better management leads to a happier person.
So in this chronic pain person, how many times would you treat them with dry needling?
Well, there's no rule, there's no recipe. Mm-hmm. Every patient is different. Mm-hmm. Every situation is different. But they certainly do require more time to reach a state of stability. Mm-hmm. So some patients may be undergoing active treatment for 2 months or 3 months, mm-hmm. but some of them respond even sooner. As soon as the patient reports an improvement in function and a decrease in the intensity of their symptoms, we back off on treatment. Mm-hmm. But we don't back off completely. We don't say that you're cured. We back off to find their equilibrium. Because anyone who's chronic will tend to get worse if nothing is done in the interim. So they need a certain level of management, a certain level of follow-up throughout. Mm-hmm. So just as a diabetic needs insulin, and a person with high blood pressure needs their medication in order to keep their condition stable. I mean, those drugs aren't curing their diseases either. We must recognize chronic pain as a real disease and respect it as such, and not just think that we should be able to kill the pain and the patient should be fine.
Right. Okay, so how long would you say, okay, you with a 10-year history of a low back problem, and you're taking, you know, whatever, you're taking Vicodin every day by the piles, what would be a, like an initial, I mean, we're going to try this for 3 weeks?
Yes. I give any chronic pain patient a definite 6 to 8 week window in which to find some level of improvement. Meaning, if we see a certain trend of response, it doesn't mean that their pain is gone.
Right.
It doesn't mean that they're not having difficulties.
But if
we see that the patient is making some positive progress in certain areas, that's a reason to continue. Because we really don't know, and there is no research to support, that treating someone X number of days, weeks, or months, or at the end of that, means that they can't get better. Some patients respond very slowly because of their family history, their occupational history, their lifestyle, their age, and the general health status. So there's really no way, there's so many variables, it's very difficult to predict in advance what the end point is.
Mm-hmm. But could you expect to have some kind of improvement within the first couple of weeks?
You can certainly see it, no doubt. Absolutely, we do see that. But I've often, every time I try to predict who is going to be that person, mm-hmm. I'm wrong. So I've been wrong in both directions, thinking that the person is going to respond quickly and they take longer, mm-hmm. and the person who looks like they're going to take forever respond quickly. So I am getting out of the prediction business.
Yeah, well, yeah, enough years in practice and you kind of know that there's such a variation.
I'm very humble when it comes to prediction.
Well, that sounds good. All right, let's take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk about the literature in dry needling, which there's quite a bit. I'm with chiropractic physician David Fishkin. He's from Maryland, and we're talking about dry needling. You are listening to Coast Community Radio. We'll be right back. We're back. You are listening to Your Health. I'm Ann Goldin, and I'm with Dr. David Fishkin. He's a chiropractor in Maryland who has a master's in public health and has been in chiropractic practice for 23 years. He has been doing dry needling, a treatment of myofascial pain since 1998, and has been teaching it since 2008. Okay, so there's research, there's been a lot of research in dry needling, mostly in Europe.
There's been research around the world. there are different types of research. There are case studies in which they may treat a certain number of people for a particular condition, or they do larger studies, or what they call randomized control studies, in which they take larger populations to compare different types of therapy. So the larger studies, which are called trials, have been mostly centered around comparing, for example, traditional acupuncture, which they call VERUM, V-E-R-U-M, acupuncture versus sham needling, which sounds illicit, but it's not. Sham needling is basically dry needling. It's not using any of the theories of acupuncture. And they've compared those two, for example, or they've compared acupuncture, dry needling, and injections. And in almost all those cases, dry needling is equal to the traditional acupuncture in terms of its benefit, and both acupuncture and dry needling are equal to or superior than injection. So given the menu of options, injection should be on the bottom of the list for people to go to, not the first thing on the list. In the area of case studies, where they take patients, a group of people with a particular condition, for example, athletes are very common to be studied. They'll take a shoulder problem or a hamstring problem, and they'll study the effect of dry needling on that versus, for example, injection or other types of therapy. So both of those types of studies, while not large enough or deep enough yet in terms of absolute number, are all quite positive.
That's comparing that. What about studies just looking at dry needling versus not dry needling? You know, no other needles, just
yes,
like some other treatment, whether it
yes.
be some kind of therapy or no therapy or exercise
right.
or whatever, like that.
That's where research needs to go. It needs to go, for example, taking addicts and seeing, you know, can you give them, for example, a narcotic substitute or versus not dry needling them in terms of helping with their withdrawal. Or even a better study would be with the elderly population to see if we can reduce their need or dependence upon a lot of the pain medicines that they take with the needling. Those studies have not been done yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a relatively new field in that sense. There's a lot to be done and a lot of interesting things to be done. And I think we're going to find, you know, I'm a field practitioner. So I'm not a researcher, so I look at what works in the field.
Mm-hmm.
And if what I see working in the field, if we walk that back to the research, I think we're going to get some fantastic studies.
That sounds fun. Of course, the thing is, it's got to be, most studies are done through institutions.
Right.
And
it needs to be institutionally based. Yes, that's the way money is distributed in this country from, for example, NIH, you know,
right.
government granting, aren't going to go to typically for this type of work to a field doctor. So we have to get the institutions involved in that. And to that end, some of the chiropractic institutions have adopted dry needling, or have already adopted or in process,
mm-hmm.
shall we say,
mm-hmm.
Of adopting it. For example, we know that in Chicago and in Oregon, the chiropractic schools there have already adopted it. And therefore, it's in the curriculum,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, that should lend itself to raising research questions and writing grants for research money.
And that will be really exciting to have that happen. So I think we should talk about Oregon as a spawning ground for dry needling.
Yes.
So for about a year, the chiropractic board, of which I'm a member, had hearings at every meeting, which are every other month, hearings about dry needling, and heard lots of testimony from chiropractors, from acupuncturists, from naturopaths, from the medical board, the pros and cons of chiropractors doing dry needling, and in the end decided it was in the scope of practice and set up a protocol, and then the Acupuncture Association filed an appeal to that and taken us to the Court of Appeals, where we have a stay. And so we're now in this turf war over this kind of treatment protocol.
Yes, I feel Oregonians should have their arms up in the air calling their legislators about this. Because as a public person with a public health background, the Oregonians are being denied their access to choose their provider of choice for getting these types of services. What's happening What's going on with the lawsuit is purely about economic turf and about control, and Oregonians are suffering for it. So doctors, for example, of chiropractic, who I already trained in Oregon, who started practicing and patients were benefiting, had to suspend and deny their patients access to that care. And that's, you know, sometimes not so bad in a dense city, but when you go out to rural communities, people don't have the choice of going down the block to someone else who may or may not deliver a similar service.
Right.
So the acupuncturists are engaged in really in a very intense, nasty turf battle, not just against chiropractors, but against physical therapists. The physical therapists are just have been intimidated by them completely.
Well, last year the physical therapists board in Oregon declared dry needling within their scope, and then they got a lot of pressure from the acupuncture board, and they backed off.
That's right, but it's how can you tell your own profession that it's within your scope, yet tell them not to do it? As a professional, it's very frustrating. I have to say that the chiropractic board went to an exhaustive level to give everyone an opportunity to be heard for over a year, and through a lot of back and forth and discussion decided it was, and even with that, the acupuncturists weren't satisfied. And by the way, it's not in Oregon alone that they're doing this. They're really acting in a legally conspiratorial manner all over the country. They tried to do this in Maryland, and they couldn't. They tried to do this in Georgia, and they couldn't. They're trying to pressure many times through the medical boards. This often they don't have their own boards. Mm-hmm. They're under the medical boards of their respective states. And they're using the medical boards to leverage that to intimidate the other professions. And the only people who are suffering, well, there are two groups, the professions who are qualified and trained to do so, but also the citizens of that state. And people should be calling up and complaining. You know, the mission of the public health people is not only to protect the citizens from bad practitioners, but it's also to ensure that the citizens have full access to their choice of healthcare provider, provided they're trained and appropriate. And it is completely appropriate for all of these doctors in these various states, especially in Oregon, in which a chiropractor can not only deliver a baby, but also do minor surgery.
Mm-hmm.
This is, by comparison, a minor procedure. So this is nothing more than an economically motivated lawsuit.
I would agree. And one of the scares that the acupuncturist threw up in the hearings was that we wouldn't be safe doing
right.
this.
And you're using a public protection argument, which is completely false, which is a bold-faced lie when you look at the training of chiropractors in chiropractic colleges. We get much more deep anatomical training. We get trained in blood draw. We can do EMGs, which are very invasive procedures. So their argument has no merit.
Well, even beyond that, if you look at malpractice suits against chiropractors doing dry needling, there aren't any.
Well, the fact is that chiropractors in general have low malpractice rates, and malpractice companies don't give low rates for free. They give low rates because there's little claims in general.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's not fair to say we don't have a long enough track record in the claims area, but we have a long enough track record as a profession to show that we're very safe and effective. And this procedure, for many types of patients, is the preferred way to treat them and is completely safe. And all the safety issues that they're raising are addressed in our training, in our education, and in the extra training that I give all the doctors that I train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be, it's strictly turf, but they've been throwing this, I mean, somebody kept saying pneumothorax in every
Yes, and pneumothorax is a potential complication. Understand this, and the public should know. Every medicine that you take has a potential side effect. Every procedure that a doctor does has a potential side effect. Manipulation has potential side effects, but everything that we do is trained to minimize those things. And pneumothorax is whereby someone who is not properly trained places a needle deep enough in your mid-back through your rib cage and causes a lung to collapse. Now, that's not a deadly event, but it's a very uncomfortable event. But the point is they're trying to make hay of this, and we are at less risk than doing this than they are. And in the way that my people are trained It will not happen. And if it happens, it will happen a fraction of a percent, you know, if it ever happens.
It seems very safe. Yeah. Right. It seems to me that a pneumothorax is most commonly seen in a sucking chest wound, not in a teeny, teeny gauge needle.
Right. I'm not going to say it's not possible, because people who are not well-trained and are too aggressive can cause it. You can cause it if you're too aggressive and are not well-trained,
mm-hmm.
and some training programs, I think, are a little bit, you know, maybe too aggressive. But even with that, the occurrence is so low as to be negligible.
Mm-hmm. Well, on another aspect, a lot of people with pain, especially chronic pain, are getting injections of lidocaine and steroids on a regular basis. And I would argue that this would be an awesome alternative.
You know what? I have no problem with medicine, with people taking medicine, with getting injections. But let's put them on a basis of what should we do first. Let's do the least invasive and the least with the least side effects. Now, all of these drugs, that are especially steroids, have many side effects potentially. So you want to save them when you really need them. Dry needling, in my case, I used to refer for many types of injections before I did dry needling, and the need for that has gone way, way down.
Mm-hmm.
So we can eliminate many of the needed injections or performed injections currently by doing dry needling first. If the patient fails, because people will fail for many reasons,
mm-hmm.
then you can send them to the other practitioners to get the requisite injections or the requisite medicine. Sometimes you have to use medicine up front because the pain is so bad it's just not tolerable, and that's
mm-hmm.
fine. But then immediately start dry needling to see if you can get past that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everything has its place under the sun, but just when is it appropriate?
Right. Well, my guest, Dr. Chris Centeno, who does stem cell research, talked about the incredible amount of cartilage degeneration when people get either lidocaine or cortisone injections.
I think one of the most unknown areas of reaction to corticosteroid injections are people who have a tendency towards mental health issues or currently have mental health issues. A steroid, for example, if someone takes a what's called a steroid pack or a medrol dose pack for, let's say, a herniated disc,
mm-hmm.
could experience a psychotic event. I've seen this happen to a patient of mine who is, in fact, an MD who was on a speaking engagement, and his back was bad. And we said, all right, take this with you if you need to take it. And his back was bad, and he had a temporary psychotic event from the drug and had to, he couldn't speak, and he was overseas. So that's one of the lesser known side effects of taking a steroid.
Well, that sounds like a ball of fun.
Not to say you shouldn't take it, but people need to know the risks. And if there's an alternative,
right.
why not?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay, give us your contact information.
Well, my teaching site is at www.dryneedlinginstitute.com. And that's it. And that's how they can reach me there.
Great. Well, thank you. My guest has been Dr. David Fishkin. He's a chiropractor who teaches dry needling in Maryland. It's been a pleasure having you, David, and I hope we can talk again.
Thank you, Dr. Goldin.
Yeah. Okay, so next week, Dig in the Dirt returns, and we will have Linda Brim here talking about emergency preparedness for your garden.